Welcome to Unveiled Faces, a Redeemer Presbyterian Church podcast. Please enjoy our feature presentation.
So there are a lot of Psalms. We've got 150 of them. And I particularly enjoy the Psalms that provide us with context. All of the Psalms either take an individual or a group of people's personal experience. You hear the emotion, the robust Hebrew way of expressing themselves in all the Psalms. But it's so nice to be able to take what we learn about the author or authors in a psalm, what we hear flowing from their hearts, and then to put it into its historical context, it gives it that much greater, understanding of what they were thinking, what they were experiencing when they wrote these psalms. And thankfully, we're given the context in this psalm. We're told at the beginning that it is a psalm of David, so we know who wrote it. And it tells us when he was in the desert of Judah. Okay, so think for a moment. Many of you have some biblical knowledge, and you think about David's life, and we know that he was in the desert twice. He was in the desert early on when he was running from Saul. And later on, he was in the desert when he was running again. Even worse, not just running from a king who was about to be deposed. He was running from his own son. So which one is it? Well, it becomes clear, I think, when we look at the last part of this, the last few verses of this text. We read this, "But the king shall rejoice in God." Okay, so he's reflecting on the king at that time. He says, "The king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exult, for the mouths of liars will be stopped." When you hear that, you realize, okay, that would not make sense for him to be saying that if Saul were king. It makes complete sense if he were king in that moment. And so we can place this really accurately. We know when it took place. We know the context. It took place when he was running from his own son, Absalom. So let's recount just a little bit about that experience. Because as we read through, as we think through this psalm, making sure we understand where he is emotionally, where he is physically, really does open the psalm up to us. So remember that this is actually after his experience with Bathsheba. This is not the first tragedy that has befallen David. It's not the first tragedy that has befallen David because of his own sin. So it's after his sin with Bathsheba. And he has either been an absent or a distracted father, as so many of the fathers in God's word, in the history of God's people, tend to be. He was about age 58 when he had the whole experience with Bathsheba. He's about 64 now, so don't picture him at 22. He's got some gray in his beard. Around the age of 64... So he's been a father a while. Maybe that's why he's gotten tired. Maybe that's the way he hasn't been paying attention. But one of the things that he missed is that his son Amnon has become the kind of young man where the normal perverseness, like, is now really in bloom, and he is desiring his half-sister Tamar. One of his sons, Amnon, is desiring his half-sister Tamar. Okay, That's bad. But it gets worse. He's so overcome with lust for her that when his cousin and friend come to visit, his friend asks him, who happens to be his cousin, what's going on? Like, why are you so glum? Why are you acting that way? And he tells him. So clearly, they're both of the kind of character where they can talk about these things openly. It just gets worse and worse when you think about it. That the family's in such bad straits their character has fallen so low that they can talk about this perverse desire as if it's like normal. And rather than his cousin saying, repent, his cousin's like, well, I can help you with that. I got an idea. We'll put together, I got a scheme. I got an idea. You can have what you want. And so they come up with this scheme, this plot. They concoct a plan to seduce her, and it effectively works. And so he gets what he wants, and then realizes that it didn't satisfy, and rejects her. And her brother, her full brother, Absalom, this is where Absalom comes in, finds out about what's been going on, which has happened, and is furious. The king, David, the father of this whole mess, has the opportunity as a father and as a king to respond in justice, to respond righteously, and he doesn't. This abdication, this sin of omission continues, and nothing happens. And Absalom's watching this, getting more and more angry. What is going on, Dad? And nothing happens, and nothing happens, and nothing happens. And so Absalom decides, I'm going to take things into my own hands. Everybody thinks things, you know, we've just forgotten about it. It's been brushed under the rug. A couple of years later, Absalom concocts his own plot to put Amnon to death. And he gets his half-brother assassinated. This is happening within a family. This is happening within David's family. Tamar's been raped by her half-brother. Absalom has now killed his half-brother and is on the run. And he's gone for a few years. Finally, David says, okay, I'm going to relent. I'm going to bring him back. And there should be, at this point, reconciliation and forgiveness. And instead, there's the cold shoulder. So now Absalom has watched his father's abdication and took sinfully this into his own hands. Now he's back and he's expecting, I think it's obvious, he's expecting there to be some sort of reconciliation, and there's nothing. His father's given him the cold shoulder. They're now in close proximity. It's like living in the same town and you never see him. He never invites him. Which takes his anger and just throws a catalyst on top of it, and now it's fiery, and he decides, okay, Dad, okay, King, it's time for a new king. And he puts together another scheme to overthrow his own father. Okay, this is the context of this psalm. Absalom's scheme works. There is a coup. David has to flee. And he finds himself once again in a cave in the desert wilderness of Judah. This is the unbelievably messy and disastrous and hopeless context in which David finds himself. And that's where he's inspired to write this psalm. So as we move through this psalm, keep that in mind. So there are many ways that we can walk through this psalm together, but today I want to do it in this way. I want to look primarily at the verbs. And some of you are thinking, oh no, verbs, grammar. Yeah, we're going to look at some grammar, but it's super simple. And I hope that I hope that you find it actually helpful, because as we look at the verbs, really what we're doing is we're saying, in this situation, what is David doing? What are the actions he's taking? What would I do in this kind of situation? What are the actions that I would or that I should take? And so by looking at the verbs, that is what we're going to see. And there's three different kinds of verbs that we're going to look at. There's what David is doing as he's writing this. What he is doing. The state he's in as he's writing this. Then we're going to look at what he did do, because he looks back, and then we're going to look at what he's going to do. So we're looking at three tenses. We're looking at the present, we're looking at what he's done, all action words, all verbs, and we're going to look at what he's going to do. And we see the what is he doing just in the first verse. So go ahead and if you have your Bibles open, if you don't, I'd encourage you to open them to verse 1. After the preamble, after the context is given to us, in verse 1, we hear him call out, "Oh God, you are my God." Look for the verbs. Look for the action words. Earnestly, I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, longs for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So in the words of this song, we hear that David is doing three things as he pens it. He is seeking, he is thirsting, he is longing. These verbs tell us something, these actions tell us that he's engaged in, as he's writing this, tell us something about him as a man, what his personal state is, and also his context, his situation. Because we only seek when we've actually lost something. He's lost. What has he lost? He's lost his family. He's lost his kingdom. We'll find out in a moment he's lost more than that. We only thirst when we have a lack of water. He is feeling a lack of water. And look at where he is, in a desert. We faint, we long when something we desire is not being, that desire is not being met, and so we long for it. We see a man here who has very good reason to feel these strong emotions. And look at the adjectives that help us, these helping adjectives that help us to understand these verbs. Earnestly, I seek for you. He describes the way in which he's thirsting, like a man in a dry and weary land where there is no water. We see that providentially he is feeling like where he is. He feels emotionally, spiritually, like he's in a desert. And he actually is in a desert. Everything about his experience is lack, is thirst, is hunger, from the outside to the inside. His body was in a wilderness, and so was his soul. Think about it. To be pushed from a throne with all of its pleasures and privileges, and to be pushed into hiding in a bathroomless cave with plenty of appropriate guilt resting on your shoulders and lots of good reasons to feel hopeless and good reasons to feel dispossessed and disconnected and depressed. Hiding in a waterless wilderness is good reason to feel spiritually dry and thirsty. He's hiding. He's hiding from his son. But notice what he's not hiding from. He's not hiding from God. He is hiding. He's hiding from his son. He is not hiding from God. He was earnestly seeking God. Seeking after God like one desperate for water. And I know many of you have discovered that in moments like this, moments of desperation or dryness, when we should be turning to God, you found yourself turning to lots of other things. Distraction. Just get my mind off of it. Sex, alcohol, video games, work. Anything to numb the pain. Maybe you really do believe that the thing that you've turned to that's not God, it might actually satisfy. Maybe, just somehow, it might work. And David was guilty of this kind of idolatry in his past, but in this moment of desert dryness, we actually see him turning back to the God who he should have been looking to all along. And this, sometimes we find ourselves in these moments of where we feel lack, we feel thirsty, we feel maybe abandoned. And it's like Job. you didn't do anything. It's not because of your sin. But that's not the case with David. David, and he's ending up here in large part because of his sin. He's lost a kingdom. He has a reprobate son. He has little hope of regaining his kingdom without losing his son, or regaining his son without losing his kingdom. And this growing storm is the result of his sowing of sin. So not only can he, like Job, lament, like, well, how did I end up here? He knows how he ended up there. And it would make sense if he felt things like regret. Oh, I deserve this. Regret. I should have done so much differently. Maybe if I'd only... ... Guilt. David would be right in feeling guilt. He should have done a lot differently. Feeling just failure as a man of God, failure as a king. He's not only lost his kingdom, but he hasn't protected those in his kingdom. They're going to suffer now to the third and fourth generation, right? The effects of our sin spill over, and he's seeing that. Doubtlessly, he's thinking of these things in this wilderness setting, feeling the bitter agony of love for his son, but hatred of him as an enemy. Can you just imagine the internal tearing he must be experiencing? And just the shame of this absolutely public disgrace. And in the midst of this mess, we see his thirst for God. He didn't turn away from God. He actually turned toward God. This thirst was good and bad. It was bad. Why was this thirst bad? It was bad because you're thirsty when you don't have something, right? You don't have water. If he's thirsting for God in this context, we know it's because he has pulled himself away from the very source of thirst quenching. He's pulled himself away from God. He's thirsting for God. Now, there's a sense in which we're never full. We're never filled. We never have enough of God. And that's a good and healthy kind of thirst. That's not what we see here. We see a man who is thirsting because he has separated himself from the wellspring of living water. So his thirst was bad in that sense, but it was good because he knows where his thirst can be quenched. He's looking back to that wellspring of water. And so this is how he's feeling. He's longing, he's thirsting, he's hungering. Those are all what he's experiencing in the moment as he's writing that. And that's just in the first verse. The next two verses, we see him do something else. Okay, this is where I am. I am thirsty. And so he looks back. We see the verb tenses change. Okay, I've acknowledged where I am. Where do I start? How do I get out of this situation? He doesn't start by looking forward. He actually starts by looking back. Verse 2 and 3, I have seen you. That's past tense. Something he did. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. He looked back. He's seen. He has beheld. Those are the two verbs. He has seen and he has beheld. Where did he look? Where was he seeing? Where was he beholding? As he's reflecting back on what he has done, where did he go? Did you notice it? He goes to the sanctuary. He remembers the sanctuary. He doesn't remember his honeymoon. He doesn't remember the birth of his child. He doesn't remember Christmas presents. He doesn't remember all those happy thoughts. He goes back to the sanctuary. What happened in the sanctuary? What was the sanctuary there for? It was at least three things. It was where God met his people. It was where the presence of God came in a very special way. And so he thinks back in the midst of his mess. He thinks back to the sanctuary where he knows he has encountered God. Number two, the sanctuary was the place of the congregation where the people of God would come together for worship. It was a place of God's presence. It was the place of God's worship. And number three, it was a place of safety, ironically. What would you do if you were being pursued by the avenger, by the person who wanted to seek your death? You would run to the temple and you would grab onto the altar and you were safe. The sanctuary was the place of God's presence. It was the place of worship and it was the place of safety. And so in this moment, what does he need? He needs God's presence. It's why he's thirsting. He needs to be connected with God and worship, and he needs safety. And so immediately he goes back there to the sanctuary. We so often run the wrong direction, especially when we find ourselves in a mess of our own making. We don't run to God. We run away from God. Because in part, in those moments, our heart, the devil, loves to speak partial truths, ironic lies. He's torn us. He's struck us. God has torn us. God has struck us. We remember, yeah, God is the God who sends the rain on the just and the unjust. He's responsible. He's sovereign over all of this. And so we crouch as if God is an abusive husband. He moves and we flinch. We turn away in fear. But David knows that though God is involved in his pain, that God is in fact the only place in which his soul can find the rest and satisfaction that his pain is actually calling out for. Hear the entire prophetic message of Hosea. Come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us. Who has torn us? The Lord has torn us. Because he's an abusive father. Because he loves your pain. Because he just wants to see you writhe. He's got a big thumb and he knows how to use it. No. He has torn us that he may heal us. He has struck us down. He has. Why? So he can bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Did you hear that? The little foreshadowing of the cross, of the resurrection. On the third day, he will rise up, raise us up, that we may live before him. If there was anyone who had reason to complain at the hard mercies of God the Father, it was Jesus, who hung guiltless but shamefully naked on the cross. And yet the promise given to the Son and the hope that he looked forward to was not of a promise of perpetual pain, but of perpetual joy. Joy that could only be found, listen to this, joy that could only be found on the other side of the cross. You cannot have resurrection without death. And the purpose of our resurrection, according to Hosea, hear it again, on the third day he will raise us up that we may live before him. What's the purpose of our resurrection? That we may live before him. You should hear echoes of the sanctuary. If you want to live before God in the most vivid way possible, it takes place here in the sanctuary. And so David, in his earnest seeking, like a homing pigeon, picture David as a homing pigeon now, he heads home in this moment. I don't know where else to go. I don't know what to do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I go home. I'm just going to go home. And he goes home to the sanctuary. It reminds me of Psalm 84 that says that even the sparrow has a place for its nest at the altar of God. He goes home. And so he looks, he thinks, he casts his mind back, and he remembers what he has seen and beheld. And what did he see and behold? Listen again. So you hear the verbs, to see and to behold. These are what he has done in the past. But what did he see when he went there? If you need hope for your desert experience, listen to what he saw. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory, because your love is better than life. In that moment, he reflects on three things that he can recall experiencing and seeing in the presence of God. God's power, God's glory, and God's love. Why would he see those things? Well, because that is what we should always experience when we enter into the presence of God and worship. We should always experience his power. We should always experience his glory. We should always experience his love. It's part and parcel of what it means to come before God's presence. But think about how these things answer his need in that moment. Remember his need in that moment. He needs rescue from an actual wilderness, and he needs a rescue from the wilderness of his own emotional turmoil. And he's responsible to a great extent. Well, having seen God's power in the sanctuary, he knows God can hear. God is not deaf. Having seen God's power in the sanctuary, he knows God can act. And that's what he needs. He needs rescue. He's in a hopeless situation. Having seen God's glory, he knows that God will always do what is good. And that his ways are not trivial. Glory is this, it carries with this idea of weight. God is weighty. He is not trivial. He is not frivolous. And he does not treat with triviality or frivolity the lives of his people. He is not a cosmic cat batting you around, playing with you until he just consumes you. He's not playing with your lives. He's glorious. And David beheld that glory. And in that glory, he knows, okay, there's purpose here. God has purpose in everything that he does. And then lastly, the third thing that he sees when he contemplates his experience in the sanctuary, he sees God's power. He can act. He hears. He moves. He sees God's glory. There's holiness in, and there's not, my life is not trivial in his eyes. And he sees, what's the third thing? God's love. He had experienced the fact that God's love is indeed better than life. He experienced that in the sanctuary. He experienced that in worship. Life apart from the communion, from communion with God, is only really a shadow life anyway. It's a mockery of life. Life apart from God is really just living death. And he's experienced that. Whenever he has been separated by his sin from the presence of God, look where he ends up. But then he's experienced in the past what it's like to be in communion with God, and that is life. Life that can only be had when you have water to drink. The water that only comes from the presence of God. So, how is he able in this moment to do this? Because he's encountered, that's a past tense, he has encountered God in his dwelling place before. He has entered the throne room and experienced the gathered worship already. This was a normal and habitual part of his life. God was not the cosmic vending machine, the fire insurance God that David just appealed to when things went bad. He had encountered God innumerable times. And so it was, in a sense, natural or reflexive for him to go back to where he had already been. And so because of that, because he knew where to go, okay, I've experienced God in the past, he knew where he could go in the future. And that's where we turn. Just for the rest of this psalm, it's primarily a looking forward. And all of the tenses change to a future tense, actually an imperfect tense. Here the verses 3 through the end. Look for the verbs. Children, look for the actions that he's expecting to take. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips, and one of the keys here, one of the flags for each of the verbs, very often is the word will. I will, or will. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. In your name, I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night, for you have been my help. And in the shadow of your wings, I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me, but those who seek to destroy my life shall go down to the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. One more verb. But the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exult, for the mouths of liars will be stopped. So when you take all of these verbs together and you look at their tense, it's actually an imperfect tense, which is, it looks to the future, but it has this sense of continuing, and it can also mean something that's starting now and continuing on to the future. So as he's looking, what am I supposed to do next? I've looked back. How do I move forward? There's this sense in the verb tenses as you bring them together that he's taking the first step, and he expects in hope for that whole process to continue and finally be consummated. This is the hope that he has in what he will experience and what he will do is based on what he's already seen. God's power, God's glory, God's love. And the will do here, I will praise you, I will bless you, I will lift up your name, I will praise you, I will rejoice, I will cling. It's both a declaration of commitment, I will do this, I'm committed to this, as well as a declaration of hope. It's a declaration of commitment. I will do this. It's also a declaration of hope in what he will experience as he moves forward. I will have hope. And this is in spite of how he's feeling. It's in spite of his experiences, his context as he's experiencing it at that moment. And notice what he's hoping will be restored again. We're going to keep coming back here. What has he lost? Because you restore something that's been lost or broken. What has he lost? Well, he lost his son. He lost his family. He's lost his kingdom. But what is he looking to in this moment? In this psalm, what do you hear him hoping and expecting will be restored? The heart of his concern in this moment, what he's hoping to see restored, what he's going to pursue even in the wilderness, is worship. Communion with God. Yes, he's lost his son. Yes, he wants him back. Yes, he's lost his kingdom. Yes, he wants it back. But that is not what is preoccupying him. When you lose things, when God takes things away from you, where is your focus? Where does your heart naturally go? What's its reflex? Well, this psalm, David wrote it, God inspired him to write it, and then put it into his word as a song to be sung by God's people, because this should be our response. When we When we sing together, the words that come out of our mouth, God will hold us accountable for. Do not be deceived, Jesus said, regarding the Pharisees. You will be held accountable for every careless word you've spoken. The words that come out of our mouths, God listens to. And so if we have been given this song, and we see David's response, and we're supposed to sing David's response, and David's response is, here's where I am, God, thirsty, longing, hungry. Here's what I've seen, God, your glory, your power, your love, and here's what I will do, God. And we're called to sing that song. That means that this is supposed to be our response as well. So like David, there are going to be times in which you feel physical, spiritual, emotional destitution. To be destitute is to be homeless. To be destitute means you don't know where your next meal is coming from. And there will be times when physically you don't know where your next meal is coming from. You don't know how you're going to pay that next bill. There will be times when emotionally you don't know how you are going to get out of the depths of your sadness. There will be times when your body is so racked with pain you don't know how can I survive another day? If God gives me another year of this, how in the world can I continue? There will be times when you will look at your life and think, I sin that way again. How can I continue? How can I come before God in worship knowing what my week has been like? Knowing how I treated my wife or my husband or my child or my neighbor or my employee or my employer? Knowing how I treated God? You know, and David, when he's expressing himself, it is not just venting. We live in a culture that is just adores venting. Do you know what venting is? It's where, a vent is kind of, you can release steam or gas or something like that. And it just comes out into the atmosphere. When we vent, it's this idea that, well, I just need to express myself. Solution to my problem, how I'm feeling. I just need to be able to express how I'm feeling. You see it all over the place in our culture. Social media is in large part about just venting. And if you tell somebody you should, that's an ungodly way to think. It's an ungodly way to feel. And it's an ungodly way to express yourself. They'll call you a hater. Say, you know, who are you? I have a right to be able to express myself. It's in the Constitution. Well, you have a right to do a lot of sinful things in the Constitution. That's not what David is doing. He is expressing how he is feeling. He is looking with truth and reality at where he is, and he does not stay there. That's not the end. That's not the goal. The goal is restoration to God. And I would submit in this psalm, the goal is to give us a picture of how we can respond to these kinds of similar tribulations, whether they've been brought on us by our own sin or not. And so David allowed the present and pressing issues that he was experiencing to point him toward what ultimately mattered. Thirst for water became thirst for God. Hunger for food became hunger for God's presence. His lack of a home reminded him of the only home that for him really mattered, the one where God dwelt. So as you reflect on your own life, what parts of this psalm sound familiar? I think for a lot of us, sometimes it's just the first two verses. The ones of personal expression. We kind of get stuck there. God is big enough to handle my concerns and how I'm feeling, and so I'm going to express myself and express myself and express myself and express myself and express myself. And we just get stuck there in that cycle of expressing ourselves. But he moves on. He moves on to remember. He moves on to reflect what he's experienced of God. And then he moves on because of what he has experienced with God. God is powerful. He is glorious. And he is loving. He moves on in hope to the future. And he takes the first step and expecting that that first step is going to lead to many, many other steps of things like praise and blessing. And the lifting up of hands was just an act of worship. And being fully satisfied and praising with joyful lips and remembering on his bed all of these truths and meditating on these truths when he cannot sleep at night and singing and clinging and rejoicing and praising again. But why don't we respond this way? Why don't we respond this way? Well, if you find yourself, I don't really respond to my trials, tribulations, sins, etc. I don't respond to it in this way. Why not? Well, what are you thirsting for in those moments? When you find yourself in the wilderness, do you thirst for God? Some of us struggle with that. And some of us struggle with that because we're afraid, honestly, in our unbelief that God really can't be trusted. Maybe we believe God is sovereign, he is big enough to do what he said he's going to do, and he offers satisfaction. But it seems kind of like an ethereal disembodied bribe. God promises, but what he's going to give us is just not really worth it. I mean, I've experienced all of these tangible pleasures. I've experienced those. Those seem very real to me. And God's promises, well, they seem harder to grasp. And so we fear that what God has to offer just simply won't satisfy. Maybe it's your view of God the Father that prevents you from seeing that his gifts are genuinely good. They're designed for people like you, people with bodies and souls. We are designed to be drinking creatures. We are designed to thirst. You are going to thirst for something. If you're not thirsting for God, you will thirst for something else. And so if you find yourself not thirsting for God, then this is an opportunity for self-reflection and honesty. Okay, if I'm not thirsting for God, what am I thirsting for? That's an idol that needs to be repented of. You cannot, if you are clinging to your idols, especially the ones that you go to satisfy, you're not going to experience the thirst that you need to have from God. You need to kill the one. The one needs to die. Be toppled. And then you will find, Christian, that your desires indeed do begin to change. You will seek satisfaction in the only place that God has designed it to be fulfilled. So if you want to prepare well for your desert experiences, you have to prepare. You have to do it before. David had gone into the sanctuary, and I know most of you are here every week. This is good. This is preparation. It's reality now. It's not just practice, but it's also practice. It is habituating your heart, habituating your voice to sing, to call out truths. For those times when it is really hard to see clearly, it's really hard to work your way through the tangle of emotions and feelings that you have that seem to contradict what just maybe a moment before you knew. It was so clear. You can't, in those moments when you need to fight, you just can't fight with weapons that you don't have. You can't draw from wells that are empty. You can't turn to a place from which you've never been. So take the time now to prepare. Get used to the weapons of God's Word. Familiarize yourself with them so you're ready to use them when you really need them. They're glorious in the meantime. They're beautiful and satisfying in the meantime. And when you need them to act not just as food for your soul, but as weapons, you'll know how to use them. Look to Jesus now when it's easier so that you're used to going to that well and it's not dry. Spend time with him so you know where to go. David knew where home was. Find your home where it should be, in the presence of God. And when you enter your desert, your wilderness, you can have confidence, as David did, that the experience will not be wasted. The wilderness is not simply something to pass through. Just, I got to endure it. God uses the wilderness journeys to prove the quality of what he has given and the truth of what he has said. We are refined and made malleable by the heat of affliction, precisely so that we do not remain standing still. I think most, if not all of you, have been to the beach. Maybe to the beach when the sun's out and it's hot. What happens when you step onto sand and the sun has been up for a few hours? You want to stand still, right? No, you want to move. The heat that God brings into our lives, whether it's from our sin or not, is for our good. It's to get us moving, like when we're standing on hot sand. So are you taking time to feed on God's word now? They really are life. And you find this out when you are suddenly in that emotional desert. You find that the only hope we have is in the food that Jesus gives generously. So in good times, if that's where you are right now, in easy times, I see God's goodness. Easy to see. Well, are you hiding God's word in your heart now? Are you familiarizing yourself with the great story? Learning to love it more and more, to tell it over and over again. Are you sharing God's faithfulness in that story when it's easy to see? Are you initiating conversations with Christians that draw your heart closer to God and to one another now when it's easy? Is your prayer life rich and growing richer? Are you learning to be eager for worship? Are you learning to sing songs? Are you seeking Christian fellowship and then actually fellowshipping like Christians? Because we can seek Christian fellowship and then not really act like Christians as we do it. Those are some things we can be doing, engaging in the good times. What about the wilderness times? If that's where you find yourself, are you guarding your heart against bitterness and self-pity? Or are you just venting? Just expressing yourself, and that's where you're stuck in that, the first two verses of Psalm 63. Are you remembering the truths that you knew only moments before to be true are still true, though the clouds have now darkened them? Are you reminding yourself that truth doesn't hinge upon your feelings? Let me repeat that, 21st century American. Truth does not depend on your feelings or even your circumstances. Are you placing your hope in those difficult moments? As ridiculous and impossible as it may feel in the moment, are you still placing your hopes in the promises of God? Are you stubbornly seeking to worship, both in private and in public gathering? Are you still worshiping, or have you closed off your heart? You know, to the extent that we do these things, to the extent that we remember, to the extent that we look forward in hope based on what we know about God and not our circumstances and our feelings, to the extent that we do that, we will be able to walk the oft difficult path that God has called us to. So if you today feel the weight of your circumstances, if you feel the inability to respond in this way of faith, God's grace and mercy extended to David 3,000 years ago is available to you today. I'm going to repeat that. If you feel the weight of your circumstances, the inability to respond in this way of faith, God's grace and mercy extended to David 3,000 years ago, it's available to you today.
This has been a presentation of Redeemer Presbyterian Church. For more resources and information, please stop by our website at visitredeemer.org. All material here within, unless otherwise noted, Copyright Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Elk Grove, California. Music furnished by Nathan Clark George. Available at nathanclarkgeorge.com.